Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. The producers for the program are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with an Egyptian commentator and journalist, Mona El-Tahawi. She was born in Egypt. She did some of her growing up in Britain. She has reported as a journalist from the Middle East and now, since 2000, has been living in the United States. Her op-ed pieces, which have been published in a number of U.S. papers, particularly the Washington Post and the International Herald Tribune, her writing have made her one of the few commentators whose work appear regularly in both the Arab and the U.S. press. And she has written particularly about issues like the struggle for reform in political reform in the Middle East, the positions of women in the Arab world, and also the progressive Muslim movement. She writes a weekly column for the pan-Arab newspaper Ashraq al-Aswat. She is a frequent guest on American radio and television news shows. As I mentioned, her opinion pieces have appeared in the Washington Post and the International Herald Tribune. She worked as a news reporter in the Middle East for 10 years. She was correspondent for the Reuters news agency in Cairo and Jerusalem. She also reported from the Middle East for the Guardian, which is a British newspaper, and she worked as a stringer for U.S. News and World Report. She's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions and comments certainly are welcome from people who are listening. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, questions, comments are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of people calling into the program is people just try to be brief in their comments, and we only ask that so that we can get in as many different people as possible, keep things moving along. But anybody's welcome to call. 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Ms. El-Tahawi, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Would you mind talking a little bit about yourself? I guess I'm just interested in and in hearing a little bit more about your background, maybe a little bit about your growing up, perhaps something about how it is you became interested in being a journalist.
Sure. I was born in Egypt. I moved to Britain with my family when I was 7 and then to Saudi Arabia when I was 15. And it was in Saudi Arabia that I decided I wanted to be a journalist at the age of 16. And it was probably because I thought it was the profession that would get me to travel the most, because I couldn't do much traveling in Saudi Arabia. And also because I became a feminist in Saudi Arabia, and it really opened up my eyes to all the things that I wanted to fight for, change for in the Middle East and in Islam. Mm-hmm. So it's probably a combination of the above. And then I also worked as a reporter in Egypt and Israel and moved here to the U.S. in 2000.
And so you say you became a feminist in Saudi Arabia. No doubt it inspired by your feelings about what life for women in Saudi society was like.
Absolutely, because my parents are both physicians, and the reason we moved to Britain was so that both my mother and father could do their PhD in medicine. So when we moved to Saudi Arabia and I compared the kind of Islam I had at home with the Islam that I saw on the streets in Saudi Arabia, I realized there was a huge disconnect, and so I began to read more. And that's what made me a feminist, and I realized that the male-dominated interpretation of my religion resulted in the Islam I saw outside in Saudi Arabia, whereas a more kind of independent, progressive interpretation was the kind we had at home.
Mm. I think you have a brother who's also a physician?
That's right, a brother and his wife, and they both live and practice medicine in Ohio.
And for you, there was no inclination to go into the family business and become a doctor yourself?
None whatsoever.
Well, I think that's interesting. In some cases, I think physicians' children are inspired to be doctors, and in other cases that maybe something about what their parents do, they decide that to be the last thing that they ever wanted to do.
Well, I tell you, my mother really wanted me to become a doctor, but she knew that my heart was set on journalism and had to give up.
Yeah. Something that I think that you have written about and other people have written about is the way that particularly the events of September 11th, but other terrorist events, those particularly those that had something to do with al-Qaeda or people that are inspired by al-Qaeda, the way that, those things have led Muslims around the world, many of them, to start thinking about their faith. Mm-hmm. And about what's required of them and about how it's appropriate to live and how Muslims are perceived by non-Muslims. And as I said, you've written about that and other people have written about it, and it makes it sound that there is a conversation that is somehow new, that hasn't ever quite happened before, particularly among people who would think of themselves or describe themselves as progressive, for want of a better word. Mm-hmm. And it's, as I say, it's something we read about going on, although at the same time, it seems to be a discussion that is, maybe it goes on among groups of individuals, it goes on in people's homes, maybe it goes on in the mosque, in different places. I guess what I'm interested in is some sort of feeling about just what sort of conversation this is, just how broadly it's going on, how open a kind of a thing it is, and who is involved in it.
I think, to be fair, the conversation probably has always been there in the background, but quietly and not so publicly and probably not noticed by everyone. And those taking part in the conversation, those talking, probably didn't make such an effort to have it be so public. But what 9/11 did was made us all realize that it was crucial to have it as loudly as possible, because if we weren't loud about it, then, things like today's Bin Laden tape or any other number of tapes or attacks were for sure going to drown out anything that we were trying to do. So I think the conversation made that jump and became much more public because we just got a really rude awakening. We were shaken awake. And now I hear it happening on every level. I mean, I have it with my friends. I have it with friends who are in Saudi Arabia who have nothing to do with, say, academic Islam or the scholarly side of things, just, regular Saudis who are trying to make a living there. And I see it happening in writers. I mean, I just returned from Egypt. I spent 4 months there. I even saw it happening on television because there are more satellite TV channels now where people are openly confronting this really narrow-minded view that has dominated Islam for such a long time. And it's exactly what we need, because if we don't define these things for ourselves, then it's either going to be the so-called war on terror or these self-appointed, so-called leaders of Islam, like Bin Laden, who I certainly don't consider a leader. But he's been setting the agenda for too long for us. So it's a conversation that excites me and gives me hope. Otherwise, these are tough times to be a Muslim, but at the same time, an exciting time to be a Muslim, because we're finally getting down to the nitty-gritty of things.
Mm. Well, given the fact that the Islam is a very widespread faith and there are Muslims living all around the world in many different countries who come out of different cultures and no doubt have different attitudes on a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Is it really possible, do you think, to achieve some kind of consensus about how we should live, how we should behave, what our responsibilities are to other people, how we should be in the world, given that we're talking about a lot of different people?
I think it's probably best that we don't have a consensus, because I think one of the things that Muslims that as Muslims we like to pride ourselves in, and this can be a double-edged sword, I do admit it, is that we don't have a centralized authority like the Vatican, say, for Catholics that kind of dictates to us what should be. And the good thing about that is that it does free up each culture. I would probably break it down culturally rather than by country, because, for example, if you go to Malaysia and Indonesia, I mean, Indonesia is the most populous Muslim country in the world. If you go there, there's been a debate on liberal Islam that's been going on there for a long time. There have been many liberal voices that have been very inspiring to those of us now working in the progressive Muslim movement in North America. So culturally over there, they have a whole set of conditions that they have to work with that are very different, say, from Muslims in Europe, that are very different from Muslims in North Africa or sub-Saharan Africa or Muslims on the Arabian Peninsula, the Gulf region. So I don't think it would be a comfortable fit if we had that centralized authority. But at the same time, because we don't have that centralized authority, you have people who'll step into the fray like Bin Laden, who'll say, this is a duty on every Muslim to do X, Y, and Z. And there isn't really that, you know, that kind of papal figure who'll step forward and say, no, you don't have that authority. Although we're seeing that happening more and more now, again, on a local level. For example, last year in Spain, the Islamic Commission of Spain, to mark the first anniversary of the Madrid train bombings, issued a fatwa that said that bin Laden has no right to speak for Muslims and that, in fact, because of the terrorism that he has inspired, he has stepped out of the religion. And we saw a similar fatwa issued by Muslim groups in North America after the London bombings last July. So I want it to stay that way. I don't want a centralized authority that dictates, but it's much more exciting to watch the local variants of this very vibrant debate happen and for us all to influence each other in whatever way we can.
That still so strikes me, though, it's difficult, given, as you have described it, the nature of Islam. If you have one group of individuals who describe themselves as progressive and have one sort of set of attitudes, and then you have some others that might be described as being conservative in the extreme, and that they are teaching something different. What do you, as a progressive Muslim, really in what way do you have any sort of ability to influence what someone else is teaching and practicing, other than saying in whatever way you can, this is what I believe, and that I think that my brother here is mistaken. In what he is saying, or it could be she, or what this other person is saying. What you really can't do much else other than live your life in the way that you think is the way to go, and to do that in as public a way as you can. It just strikes me that there's not really very much you can do about that way that the choices that other people make.
The best thing we can do is offer that alternative, because I think that alternative needs to be there clearly. We hear from so many young people who will contact the Progressive Muslim Union of North America, of which I'm a member, or who write to me individually because they've read something I wrote and say, thank you so much for saying this because we really needed to hear this. Or I hear from a young woman somewhere who'll say, I'm so sick and tired of all these other messages that are coming out at me left, right, and center, and I really need to hear an alternative. So firstly, it's that really important alternative that we want to offer. And secondly, one of my favorite sayings from the Prophet Muhammad, because, you know, in Islamic teaching depends on primarily the Quran and then the sayings in the life of Prophet Muhammad. And one of my favorite sayings of the Prophet is that he said that there'll be many interpretations and many viewpoints on offer for Muslims to choose from. And that is a mercy, in that there are certain things that are given in Islam, like the five pillars of Islam, for example. But there are many grayer areas, if you like, upon which the clerics and the scholars disagree. And for the Prophet to say that this disagreement and these viewpoints that differ are a mercy to people, I mean, that tells me that the more alternatives you have, the better. Because I fully recognize the right of everyone to go. Anyone who wants to follow the conservative traditional school is, you know, it's fully within their right to do so. But it's equally my right to follow a more progressive interpretation. And I want that mutual respect between the two of us. So that, for example, when we held the first kind of publicly recorded Friday prayer, mixed gender Friday prayer in New York last year, that was led by a female imam, Professor Amina Wadud, we held that prayer in New York, and there were 100 of us who were praying behind her, 50 men and 50 women. We didn't go around saying everybody must have a female imam to lead their prayer. The point of our prayer was that we believed it was fine. It was all right for a woman to lead a prayer. We wanted her to lead us, and we wanted that respect and that space given to us, just as we respect those who take a more conservative line and say, no, only a man can lead the prayer. So it's much more of offering the alternative and being the role models that we best can be.
Our guest in this part of Focus, let me reintroduce, is Mona El-Tahawi. She is an Egyptian commentator. She's now living in New York and has since 2000. She was born in Egypt, did some of her growing up in Britain, some in Saudi Arabia. She does writing her op-eds, which have appeared in a number of papers, particularly in the United States, in the Washington Post, also the International Herald Tribune. She writes a weekly column for the pan-Arab paper Ashaq al-Aswat, and is known as one of the few commentators who are published and who write for both Arab and American press. And as I said at the beginning of the program, and as you definitely can tell, she is particularly interested in in progressive Islam in the place of women in the Islamic world and also political reform in the Middle East. Questions, comments, certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Something that I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about is the character, if you can say such a thing, the character of American Islam. And I think that one of the things that we know about religions is that as they travel, they absorb characteristics of the place where they end up. It's like a plant, and you can take the seeds and plant it in different places, and you'll get different plants. Is there something about, do you think, Islam in America that makes it distinct?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, ever since I moved here in 2000, a theme that I've tried to bring up again and again in my writings when I discuss Muslims in America or Islam in America is that I think it is becoming a very distinct, I don't know what you would call it, not a school of thought, but a very distinct kind of character, the American Muslim or Islam in America. But precisely because, as you said, religions travel and absorb the environment around them. And one of the ways that this is happening is that we're much freer as Muslims here in America to discuss issues that are they're considered taboo or even dangerous. I mean, I come from a country where, you know, about 10 or 12 years before I left Egypt, a very prominent liberal Muslim called Farag Foda was shot dead outside his home because he dared to criticize Muslim fundamentalists in Egypt. And this was during a Muslim militant campaign against the government in my country. And he was discussing things that we can discuss, anyone can discuss in America without fearing that they will be assassinated. So this is vital to any kind of debate that we wish to have, to that conversation that is going on in the Muslim world. And I think for a long time, Muslims in America were either just kind of quietly going by their business. Many Muslims in the U.S. in particular are professional or university educated, so that this is one of the biggest differences that many people have found between them and, say, Muslims in Europe who have a different set of problems, a whole different issues that they have to deal with. So Muslims here in America were kind of quietly going by their way until 9/11 happened, when they realized that they had to be much more visible in the sense that they had to start portraying their religion in the way they were practicing it and not have it defined by either bin Laden or by the Bush administration, which was dead set on this so-called war on terror, and whatever Islam represented to it. Now, I realize, of course, that President Bush went out of his way several times to say that Islam is not a violent religion. But, you know, there were things that would come out, like the use of the word crusade and Muslim kind of anger and shared grief, if you like, that fellow Muslims were being killed and hurt in Afghanistan and in Iraq. So that's probably where you began to see more and more Muslims becoming much more vocal in the U.S. And then at the same time, I also think that Muslims in America for the longest time were almost afraid to present themselves to Muslims around the world as American Muslims because of all the trouble with U.S. foreign policy, particularly in the Muslim world. He didn't want to be associated with American foreign policy. But with each kind of attack that's been happening, with all this debate that's picking up, I'm sensing a greater confidence among American Muslims to say, yes, we are Muslims in America. Yes, we are American Muslims. And yes, we have a role to play in even leading the way in this debate, this conversation that we're having. And rather than trying to be more royal than the king and trying to kind of hold on to traditions and a certain amount of conservatism that, you know, Muslims back home, wherever home was, to immigrant Muslim population, many are moving on and saying, look, we're leading the debate now. But then the other side of this discussion, too, is that we have an indigenous Muslim population in the U.S. The African-American Muslim community has been in this country for years, and I think it's often overlooked for the sake of the immigrant Muslim population, which has been much more in the media. But in the Progressive Muslim Union, we've tried to include, you know, both indigenous Muslim communities and those of immigrant descent, because we have a lot to learn from the African American Muslim community. Not only have they been here much longer and have had to deal with whatever issues have come up for them as Americans rather than just specifically Muslims, but they also have the experience of the civil rights movement, which is a huge lesson for us all, and particularly so for those of us who still have family back home, quote-unquote, who are fighting for things like reform and human rights. that the civil rights movement is a great lesson for.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that? Someone who's listening this morning in Champaign, and it's line number one. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having my call. Sorry, I'm on the cell phone, so I might cut off at any time.
Okay.
Thank you very much for this kind of conversation, which is really needed in this time, and I don't like to take too much of your time. But I believe there are some misconceptions that always are shot toward the idea of reform. Islam being called as or divided as progressive Islam and conservative and things like that, which is totally, I think, a false accusation to Islam to begin with, because the idea of Islam was always of progression and always to renew the mind and renew the heart and renew even the body. So to put that tag on it that I am a progressive Muslim, I think it's the wrong idea, because by definition of Islam, you are a progressive person if you abide to its laws and abide to its teachings. That is the number one thing. Number two, being progressive does not have to take new laws and make new things. For example, the prayer that was held in New York, and everybody's trying to comment about it. There's no school of thought or any known scholar, progressive or unprogressive, if you like to call him, or fundamentalist, that approved of that. Yes, it was a very nice show that, you know, showed, you know, different people standing or a woman imam or anything like that. And even that the person who led the prayer was not known to be as so-called a scholar. So the idea of progression in Islam is usually going to the original teachings and original books of Islam. For example, if there are many sayings that are attributed to the Prophet, peace be upon him, or attributed to the Quran, that is so sunk in people's head that has no origin. For example, the differences between my nation is mercy between them, which has no root to being to the Prophet, peace be upon him, at all. So the problems that we're facing in so-called modernizing Islam is actually going back to the roots more than looking for new ways of words are not helping me. To progress it more and make it more user friendly, as if the word is right. So what is the idea of the writer here, to go back actually to the roots instead of looking for new ways in making Islam better? Thank you very much.
All right. Well, the caller makes some interesting comments. Ms. Eltahi, you want to pick up on any of that you would like?
I mean, my first disagreement with the caller would be that Amina Wadud, the woman who led us in prayer, is not a scholar. She spent 2 years studying at Al-Azhar University, which is basically the seat of Sunni Muslim learning. And people from all over the world go to Al-Azhar to learn how to become Islamic scholars and to go back to their respective countries to teach Islam. So she spent, you know, a good amount of time there learning about the religion, and she teaches Islamic studies at Virginia Commonwealth University, and she's respected by millions of people. So I definitely disagree with him regarding her. And I'm not so sure that I would define progressive Islam as going back to the root. If anything, I would say it's going back to the spirit of what Islam is all about. I mean, every religion at its inception represented some kind of almost revolution, if you like. I mean, the way I think about Prophet Muhammad and what he did to his community, you know, when Islam came about, he basically turned it upside down. He introduced notions such as social justice, taking care of the poor, taking care of orphans, taking care of the weakest members of society, at a time when his own community was very materialistic. And that, to me, tells me that he came about to open their eyes to things that they were just not paying any attention to. That revolutionary spirit is what I want to get back to, not whatever the roots were. I mean, the roots, there were many things in Islam that were very specific to the time then, and there were many things that can be applied at any time. One of the things that many Muslims will say is that Islam is for all time and all place. I think the essential message of Islam is for all time and on all place. But for a religion to continue to thrive and to continue to be relevant in people's lives, it has to move on. It can't be stuck in what it was, you know, in the 7th century. And this is why the point, why I brought up the point about interpretation and how different things are today from back then, and all the differing views that we have are what give us a way out. I mean, he might choose not to pray behind Aman al-Wudud, that's his right, but I choose to do so. And there is a precedent for that in Islam, which I will not get into because this is not the show about that. But I respect whatever he decides to do, and I hope he does the same for my decisions.
I guess I one thing that strikes me that I hear the caller saying, and I would imagine other people would agree, is that something like there are some people who say that Islam needs to reinvent itself, and others that would say, no, that's really not the issue. Islam doesn't need to reinvent itself. What we need to do as Muslims is try to go back to what is the essence, the essential truth, the rock bottom stuff, and that we really don't, and rather than reinventing, what we need is to get back to the roots. That's what I hear some people saying. And it's interesting, though, that it sounds as if that even people who define themselves as progressive Muslims might agree. They might say, well, yes, we do need to get back to the roots. But there, that seems, then you get into disagreements about, well, what exactly are these? What is the essential truth? Is that really something that's so difficult to talk about?
I think one of the reasons that it is difficult to talk about, although we might agree that it's that essential spirit that we need to get back to, is that a kind of more bolder interpretation of the religion hasn't happened in a long time. I mean, Islam for a long time has been stuck. It's been stuck in interpretations. I mean, when you take something like Sharia or Islamic law and fiqh jurisprudence and how all those came about, you will find that many Islamic laws were codified 200 to 300 years, if not more, after the Prophet died, at a time where a lot of those laws were very specific to what the people at the time needed. So we're talking centuries ago. And then interpretation just kind of slowed down, and many will tell you that the laws, there's a concept in Islam called ijtihad, which is one of the methods that Islamic scholars use to combine the various sources of knowledge in Islam to formulate new laws. I mean, I don't want to say new laws because I don't want to make it sound like they're inventing the religion, but new ways of looking at things that are specific to our needs today. And many people will tell you that the doors to ijtihad were closed centuries ago and that we need to reopen them because the world we're living today is very different from the world that the scholars who codified Islamic law lived in. So our needs are very different. So we might agree that, yes, we need to get back to the essence, but how do we do that? Do we do that by opening those doors of ijtihad and having these new kind of more vibrant interpretations happen? Or do we continually kind of circle over and over again all these old things that might not be applicable anymore?
I'm not sure if the caller is still there. Are we getting it all at the matters that you're interested in hearing about?
Yeah, I would like to add a few more words before I let you go.
Sure.
I'm sorry for taking your time.
No, go ahead.
It is a matter of a fundamental difference between a scholar and somebody who is interested. I don't know in what field of science or field of academy or anything that 2 years of study make you a scholar. That is my first point.
You studied Islamic law at Al-Azhar.
Yeah, I understand. I'm not trying to argue. The second thing is that Islam came as the idea of being the religion, which religion is known to be fixed and in the senses of the basics. For example, if you take a very basic matter, it cannot change with time. For example, killing is wrong. That does not make it right in any time or any any centuries that are coming, I mean, in 10 or 12 or a 1,000 century coming, killing is wrong. So the idea that the Islam that came with basic rules that are not bendable, but the idea of ijtihad that is closed at that time, that is, I'm afraid that is not true. Yes, still till this day, the idea of scholars can bring new laws to Islam is part of Islam itself. So the that brings us to the first point, that going to the root is not a matter of being strict to what 14 centuries ago used to say. It is going a matter of a constitution idea, that these are the basic ideas that will take care of your life whenever it is. It is not a matter of you will have to eat so-and-so and you always have to eat this. You have to abide by this law of this century. It is guidelines that will that does not need really progression in time. All it needs is some people who are scholars who have studied it to be modern. If you take the example of Muslim scholars throughout time, they were never only scholars in Islam as a religion and period. They were always scientists. They were always interested in mathematics. They all had their own theories in math and science and chemistry. And they are pretty much the people who are who invented modern algebra and things like that. So the idea of going back to the roots, it is not wrong. It is the very fundamental of being progressive. That is, knowledge in Islam does not equal to knowledge in religion, because Islam came out as the idea of life. You have to live Islamically. So life includes every aspect, social, academic, everything. The idea of knowledge as a scholar cannot be only a scholar in Islam itself. It has to be more than that. Thank you very much for bearing my
Long speech. Thank you very much for the comments, what you had to say. I don't know, Ms. Altahau, you want to say anything more on...
Obviously, we disagree on Amina Wadud and whether she was qualified or not to lead the prayer, but something else that the caller says I also disagree with about how Islamic scholars today continue to come up with new laws. They don't. They continue to work within the guidelines, as he called them, that were codified centuries ago. And I don't really call that new. I call that basically working within this box that was created for us at a time that is no longer here. We live in a different time now, and we need to break out of that box and start looking around us and thinking of what we need today. Mm. That's basically my last comment to him.
Well, we have another caller here I will get right to, and also I think I should, we've been talking for a while now, I think I should introduce again our guest, Mona Altahawi. She is an Egyptian journalist and commentator. She was born in Egypt, now lives in New York, and has since 2000. She's also lived in Britain and in the Middle East. Her op-eds, which focus on Arab and Muslim issues, have made her one of the few writers whose commentaries appear regularly in both the Arab and the U.S. press. She writes a weekly column for Ashaq al-Aswat newspaper. She has contributed often to the opinion pages of U.S. papers, primarily the Washington Post and the International Herald Tribune, and also does a lot of speaking and interviews like this. She, before coming to the United States, she worked as a reporter in the Middle East for 10 years. She was a correspondent for the Reuters news agency in Cairo and Jerusalem. She reported from the Middle East for The Guardian, the British newspaper. She also has been a stringer for U.S. News and World Report. And she's particularly interested in, does a lot of talking about, writing about democratic reform in the Middle East, about women in Arab society, and about progressive Islam. Questions are welcome. We have someone here standing by ready to go. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The caller is in the nearby community of Belgium, line 4. Hello.
Good morning. Unfortunately, I have not heard every bit of your conversation, and this the last caller did kind of touch on it, and your guest touched on it, but I wanted to discuss the difference between the West and, or West, I mean, other than Islam, let's put it that way, not the West, but the difference here is where Islam doesn't seem to look towards a modern view of things, but the West does. You take Ataturk tried to deal with the situation. I think even in Egypt, they've had problems with it, and definitely in Afghanistan, where people are trying to keep it more in an older sense, but then the rest of the world is looking in a modern sense, and there seems to be a real dichotomy there that we can't put together, and that's really what causes a lot of the problems with bin Laden in the West. He doesn't like our decadent society. It seems to be the real basis beyond the crusade aspect of it, of what our problems really are.
I guess what I hear the caller saying, talking about the fact that some people would argue, it appears that there is some sort of very basic disconnect between Islam and the modern world, as if somehow the two aren't compatible.
Now,
and I would expect that, Ms. Al-Tahawi, that you would say that does not have to be.
No, absolutely. Well, this is where the arguments will take place between Muslims, and this is essentially what the first caller and I were talking about what kind of Islam we practice and what the roots of that Islam is. And I think every religion has to go through this, where whatever modern is for that particular religion and whatever that religion holds to be true, invariably there's going to be a clash. And for those of us who do call ourselves progressive, it's not so much of let's jump in headfirst into the modern world. It's much more challenging what these centuries-old interpretations have done to the religion. Most of them have been male-dominated. Most of them, rather, I would say the bigger challenge, rather than just that way of thinking about Islam and when and how it was interpreted, was how culturally it's been affected. And I think that's much more pertinent to the caller's question. Because, as I said, you'll find some Muslim countries who've done a much better job of handling this. Like Indonesia and Malaysia, for example, Muslim countries in Asia have not had such a struggle. Their issues are very different to the issues that we have in the Arab world, for example, where I'm from. And so I don't know if they would call it, you know, modern versus olden times or whatever. It's much more of how the particular culture that the Islam, which is being practiced, how that particular culture affects it, and how it becomes almost this blurred line between the culture and the religion. So, for example, if you go to Saudi Arabia today, they will tell you that we have based the ban against women driving on Islamic teaching, and nothing in Islam, as far as I know, or anyone, for example, in Egypt knows, bans women from driving because everyone in Egypt drives, men and women. So there you are in Egypt, women are driving, and they're fully living in the modern age, and in Saudi Arabia, women are not driving. So it's much more of a cultural, traditional thing than just what century do you want to live in. But within the religion itself, too, there is a struggle over whose interpretation we're talking about and when those laws were codified. That I do agree with the listener.
Well, the point also I'm getting at, ma'am, is not strictly just from an Islamic point of view. It's also from a Western point of view. We don't look at things in a traditional sort of way. We always look at things in a modern way. We've got a problem here between the two cultures that goes beyond just the religion.
I think, you know, I could make the argument that, you know, just as we have the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which is much more fundamentalist in the way it practices religion, here in the U.S., there's the evangelical movement that also follows a very fundamentalist approach to religion. But the difference is not, you know, the modern approach to life per se. It's much more that you have the rule of law and the constitution here, which ensures that there's a separation of church and state. So that you can go to, say, a Mormon church in Utah, which practices polygamy, which, you know, by all accounts is not considered a modern practice. But if they're found out, they will be prosecuted because it goes against the law of the country. Do you see what I'm trying to get at? It's much more that separation of church and state than a strictly modern thing. Mm.
We're coming down to here. We're moving into our last 10 or 12 minutes, and I have some other calls I want to see if we can get to. One thing I'm interested in having you talk perhaps a little bit more about here is about Islam and feminism. You talked about the fact that you were born in Egypt and your family, when you were a girl, moved to Britain, and then after that moved to Saudi Arabia. And then it was at that point that you became a feminist, and it had a lot to do with seeing how women in Saudi society lived. What would constitute a kind of a feminist Islam? I mean, in what way would you like to see the religion embrace the the things that are important to you as a feminist?
Well, I would like to see many more women involved in the process of interpretation itself. I mean, I would say it's probably a double-pronged approach in the sense that we do need the more scholarly within the religion approach, which is where people like Amina Wadud come in. She wrote a book called Women in Islam, or Women in the Quran, I'm sorry. And there are other female scholars that I know of who've also written books that have more to do with the reinterpretation of the religion. So we need much more of that. We need women's voices to be included in the religion, but also outside the religion. I mean, I don't follow a strictly scholarly approach to Islam, but it's equally my right to say I'm a Muslim and these are the issues that are important to me. And we need people to be out there being much more self-critical, being much more introspective. And I think alongside the kind of the lack of vibrant interpretation that we suffer from as Muslims, I think we also need a much healthier dose of introspection. Instead of looking outwardly at what's been done to us or framing it into this kind of Islam versus the West thing, which I don't believe in the clash of civilizations. I think what we need to do as Muslims is look inwards and figure out what our problems are and work on them independently of whatever is going out there vis-a-vis American foreign policy, the war on terror, bin Laden, any of that.
Let's talk with another caller here in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi, mm-hmm. I'm a Muslim and I'm also from Egypt. I'd like to say salam alaikum to the speaker. I'd like to say that I'd like to bring to our listeners' attention, there's a specific verse in the Quran that says, the very last verse that was revealed that says, on this day, I've completed your religion and chosen Islam for you. And this is kind of the basis of our religion that says that everything that was completed on that through Prophet Muhammad's life is the means with which we follow. And I do choose to believe that modernity is based on man-made traditions, and we can see that there are a lot of problems that exist due to the Western modernity, specifically with women in the Western world, the way that women are objectified and sexualized. And I think that the reason that a lot of the Islamic countries seem to have a clash is because they are not properly following Islam. With regards to the more female interpretation, I'd also like to bring to the listener's attention that Aisha, who was the Prophet's wife, was foremost in deciphering fiqh or legal issues. So I think that it's very important to show that perspective, that she was one of the highest scholars that were referred to when it came to legal issues in Islam. So I think that we need to have a very complete picture. And I do agree with the speaker in the sense that a lot of these countries are monarchies, they're dictatorships, and they use Islam in order to control the people, but they are not scholars and they are not properly following the fundamentalist Islam.
All right. Well, Ms. Altaho, you comment on that any way you like.
I would say that, I'll start from the last comment. Yes, definitely the Prophet's wife, Aisha, was considered a scholar of her time, and we refer to many of the sayings that she's conveyed to us. But what happened since? I would say, where are the women since? I mean, as prominent as she was, we don't have anyone that shares her prominence today, which is why I say we need more of a female voice in Islam. And secondly, I really do not like to pose this as an Islam versus the West, because, I mean, when we started the program, we talked about Muslims in America. I mean, here we are part of the West. We talk as if, I mean, this talker and the earlier comments about modernity, we talk as if we're not living in the West. We're here in the West. We're American Muslims. And I also resent the comment about the objectification of women, because that happens everywhere. Objectification of women happens in the Muslim world just as much as it happens here. This is a male-female thing. It's not an Islam versus West thing.
I would agree with that, but I would also say I would also agree with you in the sense that it's not modernity versus Islam, because if we look at how many American white women and African-American women are accepting Islam, these are women who are choosing the fundamentalist Islamic approach, because when you follow true Islam, women are not objectified. They are honored and they are dignified.
Again, I disagree with you, because I'm assuming that you mean by wearing hijab, by living at home and having your husband provide for you. I disagree with all of those things. There's huge disagreement over what a Muslim woman should wear. And I hugely resent the fact that as soon as someone converts to Islam, a woman, she's told to immediately wear the hijab, which I actually wore for 9 years and decided to take off because I'm not convinced that it's an obligation. And there's huge there are many different viewpoints on this issue. So I really don't think it helps the argument in any sense to kind of point fingers and say, oh, you've objectified women so much that all your women are escaping into our arms. I mean, that doesn't help anybody.
Well, but the fact is that it is occurring because a lot of Western women are victimized, and the women who are abused most by the society are the ones that are turning to Islam and are voluntarily choosing, not because they're forced or not because anybody told them, but because, and I myself, I'm an engineer and I used to not wear, and because of what I saw in the work environment, this is what convinced me to cover now the way that I do, and I feel very respected now.
Well, I'm glad you feel respected, but I have to remind you that women are abused in Egypt, women are abused in Saudi Arabia, women are abused in Indonesia. This is not an Islam versus West thing. This is the point I'm trying to get to you. All this kind of conversation does is it just brings everybody's defenses up and says, well, you treat women terribly. I would even take it further and bring back my argument about the rule of law. Regardless of whatever religion you practice in this country, if somebody beats you or is or discriminates against you, you go to a court and you raise a case and it's tried before a judge and jury. That doesn't happen in every Muslim country. As you probably know, and you're from Egypt and you know what happens in Egypt, that's not the case. So let's not make it into Islam respects women and everybody else disrespects women. I really don't think that's a useful argument.
Well, what I'm trying to say is that in fundamentalist Islam, exactly what you just defined as proper justice is what is upheld. But what you're, it's not Islamic world versus West. It's the Islamic fundamentalist ideology versus what's happening.
Whose interpretation of Islam are you talking about? The one in Saudi Arabia? The one in Egypt? The one in Iran? Whose interpretation of fundamentalist
Islam? I'm talking about basing on Quran and on Sunnah and making sure that our evidence is grounded. It's not really important who is bringing the knowledge to you, but it's not. It should not be somebody's opinion. It should be based on authentic sources. That's the methodology.
There isn't one unified source on fundamentalist Islam. This is the whole point. Nobody can sit down today, and David and I spoke about this at the beginning of the show, when I brought up the point of centralized authority. There isn't a centralized authority in Islam. What you might call fundamentalist Islam, someone else would disagree with. That doesn't exist. And the point that the whole point of this show is that we're discussing different interpretations of the religion. And I mentioned earlier when I was talking about the prayer that you're perfectly entitled to follow whatever school of thought you wish to follow. But it does not help the argument in any way to say this is the best way to practice their religion and to tell everybody else that unless you follow this way, women are going to be disrespected and abused, et cetera, et cetera.
I hope the caller will forgive me for jumping in. I have some other callers here. I'd like to try to include at least one other. And having been at least on the sidelines of conversations like this before, I know we could go on for a very long time. Let us go on, though, to Champagne and line number three. Hello.
Hi. Yes. I know when you introduced the guest, you mentioned that she could talk about women in contemporary Egypt, and I know we don't have much time left, but I wondered if she could refer me and the listeners to a book or a couple of sources that would be good for sort of undergraduate level introduction to contemporary women in Egypt.
I think, you know, I would probably suggest if you go to the American University in Cairo website, they have many books in their sociology and anthropology departments that are probably a good kind of academic introduction to what's happening in Egypt. And I also would actually invite you to check out some of the blogs that are coming out from Egypt these days, because there's a very vibrant blogging community, and many of the bloggers are women. One woman in particular comes to mind. Her name is Noura Younis. I'm not sure what the exact name of her blog is, but you could probably Google her. And if I could summarize what's going on vis-a-vis women in Egypt right now, I would say that for many young women, have become very politicized over the past year or so because there's been a growing street protest movement in Egypt and there's been more of a push towards political reform. And unfortunately, last May, many young women and female journalists were sexually assaulted by the riot police in Egypt during a protest movement. And I know from speaking to those young women that that was the trigger to their politicization, and they formed a movement called The Street Is Ours, which is supposed to be like a safe place, to kind of a safe umbrella, if you like, to encourage young women to join the street protests, where you'll find a lot of the young men in the demonstration circle the women because they know what happened with the riot police before. So there's a lot happening, and I would encourage you to go to the bloggers in particular to follow it up.
Okay, and it's Younis, Younis?
Younes, or try IS, because sometimes the name in English is spelled differently.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Right.
We are just about to, at the point that we're out of time, and I'm really sorry. I'm sure that we could talk about a lot of other things and continue going. We just as a, in about a minute here, I know that's unfair to do that to you, because one of the things I said we did want to talk a little bit about was reform in the Middle East. What sort of prospects do you think that there are, either specifically in Egypt or anyplace else?
Well, the 4 months I just spent in Egypt made me very, very optimistic that there is a greater awareness in the country now of the need to push for reform. And there is this street protest movement and more people calling for reform. But I think my 4 months have also convinced me that it won't happen without external pressure. We need the Bush administration to, although I oppose many of its policies and I would not have voted for President Bush, but he needs to keep the message consistent that Egypt needs to reform. And that truly worries me because Egypt is one of the U.S.'s best allies in the U.S. So I'm not so sure how much of a message they will drum home, but we need external pressure from the U.S., from the European Union, to help those inside the country who are fighting for reform but have to deal with this brutal riot police and a president who basically does not want to democratize.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there again with our thanks to our guest, Mona El-Tahawi. She is Egyptian-born, a political commentator, journalist, now based in New York. She's been living here since the year 2000. She writes a weekly column for the Arab newspaper Ashaq al-Aswad and contributes often to the opinion pages of U.S. papers you may have seen, or you can go back and look for some of the things that she's written for the Washington Post, the International Herald Tribune. She also worked as a journalist in the Middle East. She worked for Reuters, for the British newspaper The Guardian, and also as a stringer for U.S. News and World Report, and now continues to write about and talk about issues, those that we have talked about here this morning, political reform in the Middle East, progressive Islam, feminism in the Arab world. Ms. El-Tahawi, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.